Yeah, this is Arnoldo, and I'm here with a very special edition of The Learning Brain with Dr. David Sortino. And we'll be interviewing Dr. Thomas Licona. This is KOWS LP 92.5 FM, and we broadcast from Occidental California, and we stream worldwide from our studio in glorious downtown Sebastopol, West Sonoma County.
My co-host today is Arnold Levine, and he is from England, and he was really enthusiastic about the fact that you're working with, is it Leeds University?
Leeds.
Yes, the University of Leeds.
So have you figured out the accent yet?
I wish I had a British accent. Everybody sounds so intelligent.
If you can understand what a Yorkshire accent says.
Any rate, we're moving forward. My name is Dr. David Sortino, and the name of my show is called The Learning Brain. My show addresses innovative approaches and research in cognitive and moral development that supports children's developing brain. And today's show will concentrate on an interview with educator and developmental psychologist Dr. Thomas Licona. And what I would like to do first is to sort of describe some of Dr. Licona's background, and then we'll talk to Dr. Licona. He can share with us a little bit about what he's been about and doing these days. For nearly five decades, his work as a developmental psychologist and educator has focused on helping teachers and parents foster good character in youth. He continues to direct the Center for the Fourth and Fifth R's, which is Respect, Responsibility. It's www.cortland.edu/character at the State University of New York at Cortland. And after retiring from a 40-year teaching career there in 2011, currently the center is partnering with England's University of Leeds on a character education research study on the effects of using C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia as a vehicle for fostering core values such as wisdom, justice, self-control, fortitude, love, and integrity in middle school children. And the project is breaking new ground, he thinks, by using students as a bridge to the Narnia virtues into practice in family life. He also writes a monthly parenting blog, Raising Kind Kids, for Psychology Today, based on the ideas of How to Raise Kind Kids books. He speaks to parents and educators here and abroad with his wife, Judith, and himself. He lives in upstate New York, and they have two grown sons and 15 grandchildren. One of my really favorite books by Dr. Licona, and it always has been, is a book called Raising Good Children, which I'll probably talk a little bit more about that later, because it is one of the better, and I always feel the best, books on research on moral development with young children. And anyone with children, grandchildren, or students, I highly recommend this book. The book he had worked with Dr. Lawrence Kohlberg, also my advisor at Harvard, and on the research of children's moral development. So it's a pretty amazing book. And Arnold and I have discussed Indeed. Your book at length at some other times. So Dr. Licona, why don't you pick it up and talk a little bit about what you're up to and where you see yourself going and other things, anything that you'd like to speak about, and we can go from there.
Sure, sure. Well, I'll say a little bit about that partnership with the University of Leeds in England, which has been a delightful enterprise. Where, as you mentioned, we're using the Narnia novels of C.S. Lewis, which, of course, have been made into major motion pictures. We have the children read the novels aloud in class. Then we have them think about 12 key passages in each of three novels, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, Voyage to the Dawn Treader, and the virtues and vices that are exemplified in those passages. So the kids have highlighter pens. They mark the virtues in green, the vices in red, And having identified the virtues and vices, then they reflect in writing, how have I shown this virtue myself? How have I shown this vice? How can I show the virtue more often? How can I get that bad habit under control? So there, we ask them to personalize it. And then we also ask them to focus on, among six core virtues that you mentioned, two to really take as target virtues for personal improvement during the fall semester. So they might choose self-control and kindness, for example, as two to work on. And they do a virtue improvement project. We call it the VIP. And that carries over into the home, where they do a my character self-assessment on the six core virtues. To what extent do they have them? To what extent do they not practice them? And then the parents consult on that. Which three might they work on? The parents offer three suggestions. The kids end up making the decision to pick two. And then they actually develop a plan, how they're going to work on self-control or kindness. What are the situations that challenge them? What are the strategies that they might use? And then after they try a strategy, what actually happened? How can they improve their plan week to week? And they have a weekly conversation with at least one parent on how they're doing and how they can tweak their plan to do better. And we're really pleased with the progress. We've got quantitative measures, qualitative measures. Here's, for example, a boy who makes this comment. He says, my friends don't really respect people. It's like peer pressure. They try to push me into it. Usually I would just go along with it. But when we started learning about the virtues, I knew that wisdom meant like right or wrong. And then I have to think, well, is this right or is it wrong? Hmm. So he's a 12-year-old student reflecting on how he now takes the time to think about what's the right thing. And, of course, the Greeks considered wisdom the master virtue. It enables us to discern correctly, to make a good moral judgment, and part of that is taking the time to think. Here's an 11-year-old girl. She says, before Narnia, I wouldn't have had a clue what vices and virtues were. But reading about the characters, you're like, oh, what virtue is that character showing? It's quite fun to think about it. So we're increasing the salience of the moral dimension of situations, so the children begin to view their life through their relationships at home and at school through a virtue lens.
Giving it a name,
practicing
really,
the virtue and controlling the bad habit.
What I see is, you know, when you're talking in middle school, you're talking about that. I always look at that second stage of Erikson's stage, which is industry versus inferiority. And from my perspective, it's probably the most important stage, or one of the most important stages, because it serves as a bridge to identity versus role confusion. And I believe that, you know, the kids got to experience some type of success, whether morally or cognitively, and bring that into adolescence. Because I spent years working at the juvenile hall as a moral development consultant, and the majority of those kids who came over or dropped out of school ended up at juvenile hall, never had any, the industry versus inferiority was never solidified because of the single parent home, or they didn't have fathers or whatever. So I think, you know, you addressing this middle school crowd is perfect, because it's going to carry into adolescence when the adolescent peer group starts pulling them away from the family. If you want to pick up on that, it's fine.
Yeah, people have identified that middle school period as a developmental stage where children are still very much open to positive influence from adults. Once they're in high school, things start to solidify, as you mentioned, and it becomes a little bit harder. The peer culture starts to form in a way that is often antithetical to the adult culture. Kids start figuring, well, hey, everybody cheats. What's wrong with that? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with sex, drugs, and drinking? And it's a tougher task for adults to penetrate the peer culture mm-hmm. in high school. Still possible. We know schools that have done that. We've worked with schools at high school level that have gotten the National School of Character Award and so on. If you, you create a strong enough school-wide culture and get kids involved in that, having a voice in it, helping to shape it so that they don't feel like it's something that adults are imposing on them, but something that they're at least co-creating, you can still have an influence at the high school level. But middle school provides a special opportunity, as you point out.
Oh, very. And the issue of the electronics, which is even coming in and more peer pressure, because communication is so much more detached, the adolescent peer group, and, you know, down into late childhood and or middle school, these kids all have phones now, iPhones, and
that's an enormous cultural change. I mean, mm-hmm. technology drives the culture in so mm-hmm. many ways. Neil Posen at NYU said technology brings solutions and always new problems, and mm-hmm. often we're not aware of the new problems until we're down the road and it's already reshaped our lives in ways that are difficult to reverse. Screens is an example of that. I mean, TV, of course, was a huge impact on family life. It started out with the kind of the mythology that families would gather around the electronic hearth and it would bring people closer together. They'd watch TV as a family and talk about it and so on. Of course, that didn't happen. It was only a matter of less than a decade before most children had their own personal television set in their bedrooms and parents weren't monitoring what they were watching. And in effect, the mass media was raising our children instead of mom and dad. So, you know, screens have an enormous impact. And now the smartphones have had the effect of really shutting down to a large degree family conversation because everybody's staring at their screens, mm-hmm. parents and adults. People don't make eye contact. They don't have sustained conversations. They're, you know, virtually addicted to this piece of technology, and conversation in the family life is impoverished. And we know that conversation is a crucial vehicle for transmitting values, for establishing relationships, for allowing parents to have an influence on their children's moral development. And when that's impoverished, then the moral soil in which character mm-hmm. grows is greatly impacted in a negative way. So, you know, we really encourage parents. I was just at a conference sponsored by an organization called Families of Character. Its website is familiesofcharacter.com. And it's the only online resource, really, that enables parents to focus in a very systematic way on developing virtues in family life. And one of the breakouts I did for this conference on Saturday was on screens. And I decided to do it in an interactive way, starting out by just asking people, okay, what are the positives about technology that you experience in family life? And people did a parent share on that. Then what are the negatives? And I have people do a parent share with a different partner. And then what are the success stories? How have you been able to try to curb the negative impact of technology, screens in particular, on family life? And one of the interesting problems that one person shared, which intersects, David, with your comment about identity, she said that children have so much angst about what they should post. Instagram has really ramped this up. You know, I did something at school. I won the track meet, or I got 100, or I got the part in the play. You know, should I post this? How should I post it? Mm-hmm. The feeling that you've got to share your life mm-hmm. with the world, or somehow it's not real. Mm-hmm. And then another mother said, yeah, and the other thing is you're constantly comparing what you post with what somebody else posts. She says her daughter goes online. She sees Facebook pages from her friends that look as if they have these absolutely wonderful lives, mm-hmm. all these great things happening, and the daughter comes away depressed every time she compares her life with somebody else's. Oh, wow. So there's this pressure to go public with your life. There's this comparison with other people's lives that look so much greater. And it's just ramping up the anxiety that kids experience, and they don't have a sense of who they really are anymore. They're living in this virtual world, which completely distorts normal development.
How does it work with, Dr. Glacona, we talked about peer pressure, but how does it work with peer mentoring with middle school kids?
Well, peer mentoring is a strategy that a number of schools have used productively, even for things like making a transition, say, from middle school to high school. They'll have a ninth grader in first year of high school and on a mentoring day come down and pair up with an eighth grader saying, well, look, here are the things that I was worried about when I had to make the jump to high school. Here are some things you can do. Here are some clubs you can join, sports you can try out for, mistakes not to make that I made, maybe. And then some schools have continued that, where every freshman gets a mentor from an older student, a junior or a senior, who will pair up with the freshman and stay with them for the entire freshman year, giving them guidance, meeting them once a week, how's it going, what are the challenges you're facing, but basically just providing the support and guidance that enables freshmen to stay on track, to, you know, not flunk courses, to keep on their studies, not get involved in bad behavior because of negative peer pressures and so on. So the Peer pressure is a two-edged sword. We often speak of the negative peer pressure because of the problems it causes, but positive peer pressure can very much support children and bring out their best.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to plug a book. A friend of mine, a psychiatrist, name is Victoria Duckley. Dr. Victoria Duckley has written a great book called Reset Your Child's Brain. And basically, she addresses the issue of electronics and what parents can do to be able to control and try and, just make the whole electronic journey with these kids a little bit more under control. So her name is Dr. Victoria Duckley. She practices in Los Angeles. But at any rate, anyone is interested in dealing with the electronics issue, her book is very good.
David, actually, I'm indebted to you for making me aware of Victoria Dunkley's Reset Your Brain book. I had not come across it.
Oh, good.
And then I logged on to her Psychology Today blog, right. And I ordered several copies of her books, actually, so I could have a couple to give to our children who are raising their kids now. And I was tremendously interested in the work that she's done through her therapeutic practice. You know, she, as you remember, she started out in this direction of trying to help parents get control of screens because she was seeing more and more parents coming to her saying, "And my son is revved up all the time, can't focus, totally defiant. My daughter's exhausted, has meltdowns even when she slept enough." And so she started an online parents course on reducing kids' screen time called Save Your Child's Brain. Mm-hmm. And she got dozens of calls from moms around the world saying, intuitively, they thought too much screen time might be the cause of their child's symptoms, but their concerns have been dismissed by their child's pediatrician or therapist. Uh-oh. And so Dunkley's suggestions about curtailing screen time were a salvation.
Well, you know where I'm at on the ADHD. We're up to about 11%, and a lot of it is due. I see a lot of my clients who come in on ADHD identification, and the first question is how long are they on the iPhones, and you know they're not getting enough sleep because you need the REM sleep and then at least six cycles, and so eventually, you know, I'm able to sort of convince them that it's a problem with dopamine. If you're used to getting rewards and reinforcements with your brain, particularly during whether it's middle school, late childhood, adolescence, the brain is still, the second renaissance happens in 16. And that's when the brain really develops into maturity, and that brain is still flexible and growing. And Victoria is doing great work.
And you can find testimonies from moms who have done the electronic fast that she recommends.
Yeah,
you know, if
you
go on Amazon, you read the people who have read her book and used her recommendations on fasting from all screens for a month. Parents are amazed by the transformations that occur in their kids. The brain thing is interesting. I started to talk about that a little bit when television became increasingly a problem, and we were experiencing that raising our own two sons. They'd watch 2 hours of cartoons on a Saturday morning, and they would be cranky, logy, didn't want to play, didn't want to do family chores, you know, just were no good for anything because of 2 hours in front of the set watching those cartoons. And, you know, my wife and I would notice the same thing ourselves. We'd watch a show at the end of the hour. You can feel the difference in your brain. And then I started looking at some of the research showing that, you know, when you read an article, it's like doing a puzzle. You get the alpha waves, the little jagged brain waves. Mm-hmm. When you watch TV for an hour, you get the beta waves, which are close to sleep.
Sure.
And so it puts you into this funny state where you're really not asleep, but, you know, you're half asleep. And the electronic stuff has a huge effect on our brain.
Yeah, and it's basically what we're looking at with the brain itself, and I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but other than the fact that we're looking at a 20-minute on, you know, say 5-minute off when a child is, whether doing homework or whatever. But with the electronics, they're pushing their brains like pushing your body to a place where they're forcing their brain to try and be focused for a certain period of time, and that's where the addiction comes in, and they need more and more, and so they go into a really state of withdrawals, and that's when you get that type of behavior with the kids, and basically it's a withdrawal, the same symptoms, whether someone is on a type of amphetamine or whatever it might be, but Not to change the subject, I was going to ask you about your Raising Kind Kids. Now, is that came out in 2018 with Penguin Books Publishing?
Yeah, that came out last April, How to Raise Kind Kids. Mm-hmm. Penguin published it and focuses on kindness, but it also argues that kindness needs a supporting cast of 10 essential virtues that help kids to be kind. Those include wisdom or good judgment, self-control, gratitude, respect and responsibility, a set of virtues that are really interdependent, because the virtues really don't function in isolation. They each need each other, and they draw support from the supporting cast, as it were. And with the book, the main theme of the book is that we're raising kids in a culture which is, in a sense, hostile to moral development. It's hostile to raising kids of character. That it's changed in at least four ways that present new challenges to raising respectful and kind children. One aspect of that is that we're in an increasingly angry, polarized, and uncivil public culture. The political culture is highly toxic. Mm-hmm. Second, there's a culture of entitlement in which parents are doing all the giving, kids all the taking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was a poll a few years ago in which most parents, something like three-quarters or two-thirds of parents at least, said that they felt they had spoiled their children. Mm-hmm. And you get kids basically doing all the consuming, parents all the providing, and the kids end up with a sense of entitlement, like the 15-year-old boy who said, "Why should I mow the lawn? It's not my lawn." So that's another problem. A third is the dominance of electronic screens, which you mentioned, which has bad effects on the brain, bad effects on family life and conversation. And a fourth is the hypersexualized culture that normalizes extreme behavior, undermines healthy development, exposes kids at increasingly early ages to hardcore pornography and so on, and creates all kinds of problems as a result of that toxic influence. So you have a set of cultural factors which, taken together, make for a much tougher environment in which to grow up, in a much tougher environment in which to parent. So what I try to do in Kind Kids is say, look, all right, that's the reality we're dealing with. If you want to have a chance as a parent to be effective, you have to be countercultural in significant ways, pushing back against these forces. That means creating a strong family culture of kindness and respect, with norms that expect behaviors of kindness, behaviors of respect, that nurture that in systematic, deliberate ways. Increasingly, parents need to be intentional if they're going to push back against the toxic culture.
You know, one of the things that we've demanded at my house is the Sunday family meeting or the Sunday family dinner. And we've always encouraged that with our two daughters. The one's 1923, and we've been doing it for years where you do the appreciations. You talk about the upcoming week. This is something that I grew up with in an Italian family where you were required to be at that Sunday dinner, no matter what. You could not, and up into adulthood or whatever, they bring over their boyfriends are now coming to our Sunday family meeting dinners. And I've always, I always stress that to my client, to the parents. You have to establish a structure that brings the family together, that is on a schedule, and where we get together and you share food or whatever you're sharing. And now my children will call us or something if we're not at home, we can't do this. They'll come to our house and have the family dinner themselves. And it really is, that's something that has been missing in the families is kids are so scattered and they got their iPhones or this and that. But that's something that I've always encouraged with my kids. And now they're adults and they require it.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's a great story about how much they value it as adults, having experienced it as children. Kind Kids book, there's a chapter on discipline, and the first strategy is keep building an intentional family culture.
Exactly.
Because that gives you something to draw upon. When you have to correct your child for misbehavior, where you need to sit down and give them a talking to, or maybe where you need a consequence for something that they've done, if you've got a relationship that you've built up, you've got something in the bank, they're going to listen to you, you've got much more power to have a constructive conversation that has a chance of influencing their character than if you don't have those kinds of connective rituals that have built up the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And, those connective rituals can take many forms. They can take the form of the family dinner, worshiping and praying together. Mm-hmm. If that's part of your family culture, bedtime reading, scheduled time outdoors that you spend with your kids, everybody pitching in the family work. They're all kinds of family rituals and traditions that psychologists are calling connective rituals, because they deepen the relationships and they give you leverage in your parent-child mm-hmm. relationship.
Well, you know, this is generational for me, because every Sunday where I grew up, we went to my grandparents' house. All the cousins would come in, the aunts, the uncles, and there'd be food. And that just carried over to my parents and now to my children. And you're right, this is a generational which is passed on, which is missing, maybe because geographically people are so scattered today, but they can do it. You can easily do it if you're with your children. And
I think it's a matter of realizing how important it is that it will stay with them, because I know parents who say the same thing that you're talking about. They're adult children. When asked, what's the most important thing that we did that you want to carry on with your kids, will say the family meal. Mm-hmm. That's something that has an enduring value, and that becomes something that carries across the generations. There's an interesting project that you may know about called the Harvard Family Dinner Project that provides free weekly recipes to families, along with conversation topics that they can use to get good talking going at the table. And they cite research showing that these regular family meals, whether you do them for breakfast, whether you do them for dinner, are associated with a whole range of outcomes that have been documented by the research. Lower rates of depression and anxiety, stronger resilience and self-esteem, reduction of teen pregnancy and drug use, higher grade point averages, and so on. So, all kinds of benefits flowing from gathering together in that connective ritual of a shared meal. I think if parents understood the value that it has, they would be perhaps motivated to try to project the time for it. And then you have to have meaningful conversation. And when parents experience that, also it changes their relationship with their children. You can say, what's something kind that somebody did for you today? Or what's something kind that you saw somebody do for mm-hmm. somebody else? Or maybe mm-hmm. something nice you did. Or what are you grateful for today? Or what happened today that was a surprise that you didn't expect? What was an interesting conversation you had? Was something you learned from school or life? Mm-hmm. They're all kinds of topics like this that bring out thoughts, feelings, and experiences, and they make dinner conversation cohesive. They bring you closer together. They provide an island of intimacy and family life.
Yeah, and going back to the brain, the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain for bonding. It's the only part of the brain their neurons regenerate. And I see the family meal or the dinner or whatever as a sense of bonding. And we're going to that higher area of the brain, which is associated with, just higher learning. And actually, it's a bonding experience. And when the kids can bond in this situation, they're actually going to the higher centers of the brain. And that stays with them. And if you could start at a young age and carry that over, it's wonderful for them,
And there are things that flow out of that. For example, mm-hmm. if you get the family meal established, right, that mm-hmm. gives you a base, and then you can go into other kinds of intentional strategies, creating a family mission statement, mm-hmm. for example, that makes kindness something that's normative in the family. And that's just a set of we statements. You sit down together and say, what kind of family do we want to be? And then you identify the core values and virtues you want to live by, and then you generate we statements that reflect those. For example, if kindness were central to your family mission statement, the we statements might be things like, we show kindness through kind words and mm-hmm. kind actions. We say we're sorry when we've hurt somebody's feelings. We forgive and make up when we've had a fight. We show respect by looking mm-hmm. at and really listening to somebody when they're talking to us, mm-hmm. and so on. And so that family mission statement then gives you, kind of a family manifesto that you use as a reference point. If something goes off the rails in the course of the week, you say, okay, what are we forgetting, guys? Sure. You look at your family mission statement, mm-hmm. and it helps you renew your commitment. And then the family meeting also can flow out of something like the family dinner, mm-hmm. where you start using a gathering to solve the kinds of problems that need solving. Okay, last week was a tough week. Everybody was in a mm-hmm. bad mood. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of yelling, and we'd like to have a better week next week, more peace and more cooperation. So what can we do? How can we change that and have a better week? And then you start to brainstorm. Everybody gets voice. People all contribute their thoughts, and you write up some sort of a plan for doing that. And families that have tried the family meeting are often amazed at how much progress they can make in a short time at pulling the family together to be to have a kind of a team spirit. We got a problem, we can solve it. Let's sit down and talk about it. And they get this mindset, if you've got a problem, you talk it out. And even single moms or single dads can use this. Here's an example of a mother. Whenever she got on the phone, she said her two sons, who were 7 and 5, would just go wild. They would misbehave. They would make mm-hmm. it impossible for her to talk on the phone. She was a second-grade teacher. She needed to talk to his parents about mm-hmm. about their students' issues in school. So she learned about family meetings. She sat down, and she said, look, in a family meeting, we're going to try to find a solution that's fair to everybody. And the kids, of course, weren't used to this, so they said, are you going to tell Dad? You know, I haven't been so mm-hmm. bad. And, you know, but then she got them beyond that fear of punishment thing and yeah. thinking about, okay, what's everybody's point of view and how can we work out something? And turned out, from the children's perspective, she was on the phone so much of the time, mm-hmm. she often didn't keep a promise to play a game with it. Mm. With them at night, and they made a plan to do, and they really resented all of her time on the phone with people outside the family, so that was a revelation for her. So their agreement ended up with a phone solution. Mom has promised to do something with us. She'll tell the person she's busy, and we'll call back later. We'll make a list of things to do while Mom's on the phone. Mom will try to make her call shorter, and if Mom has to be on the phone for a longer time, she'll tell us, and we will behave. And then Mom mm-hmm. and Philip and Ben all signed that, put it up on their refrigerator. And she's in the follow-up meeting, which is very important. 2 days later, she said things were much better. And she had tried everything else, you know, yelling at the kids, punishing them, bribing them. Nothing worked. But when they sat down together, everybody had a point of view. They were able to solve the problem.
Dr. Thomas Lacona, a psychologist and educator, author, and he is director of the Center for Fourth and Fifth R's, which is Respect and Responsibility. And he has taught at State University of New York in Cortland for 40 years. And he's published, again, a wonderful book called Raising Good Children. And his newest book is called Raising Kind Children. And we're just discussing, you know, looking at children's, the different values and morality of what it's like to raise kids today in the electronic age. And we were just discussing about how family meals can play a big part in bringing the family together. And it's just a place where people can share their experiences, weekly experiences. You know, and I haven't mentioned Larry Kohlberg, of course, but Dr. Kohlberg was a moral development, we're talking of the conformity stage, where when you create a situation where children can conform in a positive way, they hold on to that. And then when you include food, which is a very grounding experience where everybody participates in making the food and the meal, it's also very grounding. It's very primal. As an Italian, that's how we communicate food. So at any rate, what do you, Arnold, do you have anything to share on this?
Yeah, well, yes, really, talking about different cultures. Going back to your work on the Chronicles of Narnia, say, now, obviously, C.S. Lewis had a very Judeo-Christian look at the world. How do you integrate that in your work to modulate it for different cultures, or does it have to be?
Well, interesting. I mean, you're quite right that Lewis's Narnia stories function as Christian allegories. But many scholars, including people of no Christian faith, have defended them as just good stories that work on the level of narrative. They have adventures. They have great characters. There are supernatural forces. But then, of course, that's part of lots of children's stories and novels these days. So, you know, you don't have to read them from a religious perspective. But if you happen to be doing the Narnian Virtues Project in a Christian school or a faith-based school, you can then, you know, speak about Aslan as a supernatural creature who perhaps can be seen as God, and you can play out the religious meanings. But actually, we're doing the project in multicultural settings. Most of them are not religiously affiliated schools in England. A couple of them are Catholic. There's one school in Birmingham, which is 80% Muslim, and you know, they've had a very enthusiastic response from both the teachers and the students and the families that are doing the family part of it. So it's working out well in the multicultural context. The virtues, of course, transcend religions. They transcend cultures. Lewis made the argument in his book, The Abolition of Man, that these virtues represent a kind of moral law, which you can find in the traditions and values of ancient cultures and diverse cultures around the world.
My name is Dr. David Sorrentino, and the name of my show is called The Learning Brain. I work with children. I've done residential treatment, worked at Juvenile Hall, and we're discussing the issues of how we can have children and adolescents move to stages where they're more respectful of each other and to try and create some type of cohesion in our environment when it's just so disjointed these days. Arnold, you have something to share?
Well, just a more contemporary thing. Obviously, last week with the Kavanaugh hearings, not on the politics side of it, but what lessons, obviously, do young middle school boys get from this? What did we learn? What did they learn?
Well, that's an excellent question. In the Psychology Today blog that I write, Raising Kind Kids, the very first post that I made back in, I guess it was February of this year, was how should parents talk to their kids about President Trump's asshole remark, where he said, why are we taking so many people from these SHIT whole countries? Mm-hmm. And that set off a storm of controversy because it was such a denigrating remark and, of course, ignored the reality of American history, which which is a story of immigrants. We're all immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so, but the question is, where do you go with that as a parent? And how do you do it in a way that really transcends your political partisanship? You know, you could use it as an opportunity just to say a lot of negative things about the president, or you could use it as a deeper opportunity to say, well, you know, why is this a problem? What behaviors are we seeing here? If you look at the Kavanaugh hearings, you know, what kinds of behaviors are we seeing? What represent good character? What are ways of maintaining self-control under this kind of pressure? And, of course, people make criticism of the various players in the whole thing. Some argue that Judge Kavanaugh lost a lot of control and he defended himself. And then how do you get at the truth is another great question.
Right.
It's very difficult when you hear conflicting accounts and both people insist that they're telling the truth. How do you sort that out? Well, you can try to gather more data. You can have an FBI investigation. Well, what if that's not conclusive? And in the end, you often have to make moral judgments in the absence of 100% certainty. You don't have necessarily metaphysical certitude about who's telling the truth and who's not, or what the nuances are, and et cetera, et cetera. So there are lots of opportunities for discussion, and it doesn't have to be preaching at kids. You know, stimulating their reflection, raising the important questions. What are the qualities of character that we should look for in our leaders? How do you decide who to vote for? You know, all these kinds of things are important character questions that can make the most of what otherwise might seem like a bad thing for the culture. You know, our leaders setting terrible examples. But it can be turned around, and we can try to wrest a victory from what might be the jaws of defeat in those kinds of instances.
You know, I went through the Vietnam War situation when I was in college, and my father was a Republican and vice versa, and Sunday, you know, we were talking about the Sunday meals, but they were definitely energized, and I would say that our population eventually healed itself because of the Vietnam situation, and we can learn a lot from that period for whatever reason, about what we're going through now. So
I think that's a hopeful point, David. Mm-hmm. I think that for all the problems of our culture, it has, when somebody said healthy cultures have the capacity for self-correction.
Right.
Just as in the individual child's character or moral development, you want to give them opportunities to self-correct. Mm-hmm. You know, can you say that in a more respectful way? Can you say that in a kinder way? Can you solve this problem in a peaceful way? You give them the opportunity to have a second chance at it. Mm-hmm. And And I remember after Watergate being in Canada, where some Canadians said, well, one thing we admire about you Yanks is you're not afraid to wash your dirty laundry in public.
Right. That's
and I
true.
Think that that's a healthy thing, that we are willing to examine our faults and failings as a society. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, they give us the moral ideals. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, sure. the Gettysburg Address, all those things hold up the ideals that we have to strive for. We haven't perfectly realized those ideals. You know, our growth as a society is a work in progress, just the way our character is a work in progress as individuals. But all these things are opportunities for development. And I think parents can look at some of the negative stuff out there as opportunities for positive growth in their children and their families.
I have a 19-year-old at home, and I'm very optimistic that what had happened in Florida, tragedy in Florida, where these students went out throughout the country, and the gun situation. Sam, I'm optimistic about the fact that they are going through something completely different. From their point of view, it's a sense of, you know, survival, guns. And I think that's going to be a trigger for them to go to another level. My daughter is addressing these situations. They're getting involved with groups. They're registering to vote. So I saw that tragedy as something that is motivating another population, a generation of kids, to go further.
And that's, I think, another positive lens to mm-hmm. to use to view some of the terrible tragedies that we suffered through. Yeah. That you know, whether you have a religious perspective that God brings good out of bad, or whether you right. just have the virtue of optimism, looking for the silver lining, the ways that you can turn a terrible experience into something hopeful. There are these opportunities to see the good, and we want our children certainly to be able to do that. The walk out after the shootings, you know, the mm-hmm. protests. The challenge there, and this is the subject of a Thomas Friedman column in the New York mm-hmm. Times, mm-hmm. is to understand the hard work of actually bringing about grassroots change. You know, if you're going to get involved in producing social change, it's not just a one-day walkout as part of a school protest. You find out how to influence public opinion. Maybe you write a letter to the editor, or maybe you sign up to work in a voter registration drive, mm-hmm. or you sign up to work in somebody's political campaign if you think that they're going to support reasonable gun control and so on. So there is the hard work of actually making social change happen, and we need to talk to our kids about that too.
So we're basically going to close, and again, I feel optimistic. I want to close with the word optimism and what we're discussing. We really appreciate you coming on and spending this time to talk about such important topics and the work that you're doing. I encourage individuals to go to your blog on Psychology Today. We'll just look for more energy from you.
Well, thanks, David. It's been a pleasure to follow your work as well.
Thank you.
Your books on children's learning and brain development have been an opportunity for me to learn a lot more about that. So
well, I
wish you well with your continuing publishing and your radio show and all your good work. Arnold, thanks for your participation in this, too. Appreciate your perspective. That was a great question about the Lewis novels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate you being on. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, and let's move forward.
Yes, all right, thanks, David.
Thank you. I'll be in touch.
Bye. Sure.